ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 7th of March. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Nikki Haley continued longer than many thought possible, but the former South Carolina governor has now pulled out of the race for the Republican presidential nomination. Her announcement came hours after Donald Trump swept to victory in almost all of the states voting in the Super Tuesday contest. But Mr. Trump's former UN ambassador stopped short of endorsing his run for a second term. North America correspondent Barbara Miller is in Virginia and compiled this report.
Good morning. After a bruising Super Tuesday, Nikki Haley called it a day.
I am filled with the gratitude for the outpouring of support we've received from all across our great country. But the time has now come to suspend my campaign.
The former South Carolina governor did win a state, Vermont, and had a decent showing in some pockets elsewhere. Here in Charlottesville, Virginia, she took 74% of the vote. But Donald Trump had wins in 14 other states, some of them by huge margins.
Look at that divide. This is Donald Trump dominating the evening.
J. Miles Coleman is an editor of the election newsletter, Sabato's Crystal Ball, at the University of Virginia.
Haley's biggest problem was, in a lot of states, she would win independent voters, kind of softer Republican partisans. But when it came to those actual registered Republicans, Trump would blow her out. And it's like, okay, you can't really win a Republican primary by appealing to non-Republicans.
Unlike many of those who've gone before her, Tim Scott, Vivek Ramaswamy, Ron DeSantis, Nikki Haley did not endorse Donald Trump, instead challenging him to reach out to her supporters.
And I hope he does that. At its best, politics is about bringing people into your cause, not turning them away.
In a post, Donald Trump said Nikki Haley got trounced, but he did invite her supporters to join his MAGA movement.
If I were him, I would go down to South Carolina. I'd try to break some bread with Nikki Haley. But you know, oftentimes with Trump, you know, there's the politically smart thing to do, and then there's what he actually does. Sometimes those things are in alignment, but sometimes they're not.
Joe Biden had a good Super Tuesday, but significant minorities in states, including Minnesota, lodged protest votes. The president is now also reaching out to Haley supporters, telling them there is a place for them in his campaign. Nikki Haley's departure makes it almost certain that the 2024 election will be an unpopular Biden-Trump rematch. J. Miles Coleman.
Now, it's like if you get to the office one morning and you get an email from one of your kind of co-workers, oh, I brought donuts this morning. When you finally get out to go eat your donuts, the only two left are the ones that no one likes.
The next 8 months could feel like a very long time in U.S. politics.
Thank you, America. God bless you.
This is Barbara Miller in Charlottesville, Virginia, reporting for AM.
The latest report card on efforts to achieve equality between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians once again makes for grim reading. The Closing the Gap data shows just 5 out of 19 targets are on track. And while there is some welcome news, it also points to worrying trends in justice and child welfare. Isabel Masali reports.
Queensland mother Lana will soon welcome her 4th child. She's not Indigenous, but she knew carrying a First Nations child comes with challenges. So she's relieved to be part of a program that supports Indigenous babies.
For me, finding somewhere that was, I guess, not just a straight medical model, but more integrated, you know, with a strong focus on culture, a strong focus on women, a strong focus on connection to community and family and just the bigger picture.
The program is one of many initiatives that's helping Australia stay on track to reach the highly anticipated goal where 91% of Indigenous babies are expected to be born at a healthy weight by 2031. It's the big winner out of the latest Closing the Gap target report. Dr. Yvette Rowe is a Ningniyayaru woman and Professor of Indigenous Health at Charles Darwin University.
Having a healthy baby that's born at the right time, at the right weight, with a whole range of supportive mechanisms around it is critical, not just for that baby, but for across the generations.
Birth weights are one of 19 socioeconomic targets tracked in the Closing the Gap campaign, which aims to reduce inequality between First Nations people and the rest of the population. Right now, 5 targets are on track. Minister for Indigenous Australians, Linda Burney, says it's clear there's a long way to go, but adds in the talk of targets and numbers, one thing shouldn't be forgotten.
They're real people, brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, aunts, uncles, and it must always be remembered that we're actually talking about real people.
Minister Burney welcomes the latest data on birth weights, saying it has enormous flow-on effects, but areas with a lack of progress or even a decline include the alarming rates of Indigenous children in out-of-home care and the over-representation of Indigenous people in prison.
The disappointing thing is that there are targets that are still going backwards, particularly the outcomes for Aboriginal people in incarceration.
Minister Burney points to a range of new measures, including a National Commissioner for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People, to focus on youth detention and out-of-home care. It's an initiative Dr. Hannah McGlade has long argued for. The Noongar woman is an associate professor at Kernan University and a member of the UN Permanent Forum for Indigenous Issues.
We need to be doing a lot more. We need to be investing into prevention and early intervention and ensuring that there is Aboriginal self-determination in child welfare responses.
The Productivity Commission will release more Closing the Gap data later this year.
That's Isabel Massali reporting with Kirsty Wellauer and Stephanie Bolchi. The federal government has announced that it will pay 12% superannuation on publicly funded parental leave, but it won't happen until after July next year. The Social Services Minister, Amanda Rishworth, joined me earlier. Minister, how much of a difference do you think this will make to women's retirement incomes?
Well, look, at the moment we know women retire with 25% less in their superannuation accounts than men do. And, of course, we want to see that gap narrow. This will have an impact on women's retirement. It will lead to women having thousands of dollars more in their superannuation account. It's not the silver bullet. It won't fix this gap, but it will go some way to reducing that income gap, because we know that women, when they take time out of the work, as also with being paid less, that does lead to that difference in retirement savings.
This change is happening from July next year. Why not this year?
Well, look, obviously there's a number of things that need to be put in place. We need to get the legislation through the Parliament, but indeed there's also changes that will be needed to be made to the ATO, Services Australia. So this gives us enough time to implement. But at the same time, we don't want to wait too long, and that's why we've committed to the 1st of July 2025 as the start date.
Will this apply to businesses across the board?
This will apply to the paid parental leave that the government pays. And so for those women and men that qualify and are eligible for the government paid parental leave, then they will receive the superannuation guarantee on top of that. And that will apply to anyone, any individual that receives the paid parental leave scheme that the government administers.
When we're looking at this paying superannuation on parental leave, how much will that cost the government?
Well, look, the final details are in the budget, and the final costings will be in the budget. Of course, we know that there is about 180,000 families on average that rely on paid parental leave every single year. And by the 1st of July 2025, there will be a 12% contribution. But the final details of the costings of this policy will be in the budget.
Many older women are already dealing with this gap in retirement income. What measures are you putting in place for them, those who are already in this situation?
Well, look, of course, we need to look across the board at how we better support women. And some of the changes that we made in the last budget was those women that rely on JobSeeker, for example, older women, we increase the higher rate of job seeker to extend down to people 55 and over. We also increase rent assistance. We know that many women in an older age group do rely on rent assistance. So that's some of the measures we've taken, particularly for those women, older women that are facing economic hardship. But of course, one of the really key areas is to close the gender pay gap. If we're able to close the gender pay gap, then we will also see women retire with higher super balances.
Amanda Rishworth, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Amanda Rishworth, the Social Services Minister. In the 2 years since Vladimir Putin launched his full-scale invasion of Ukraine, speaking out against the war has been criminalised in Russia. But a group of mothers and wives of soldiers serving on the front lines is pushing the boundaries and calling on President Putin to return their men home. Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane has the story.
Maria Andreeva would have to be one of the bravest women in Russia. Each Saturday, she leads a group of around 20 women protesting against their husbands and sons being kept on the battlefield in Ukraine. Outside the Kremlin, they visit the tomb of the unknown soldier, lay flowers, and call for their men to be sent home.
I simply no longer want my husband to give precious years of his life to the army of the Russian Federation, which, I'm sorry, will not take care of us after, and I don't want him to risk his life there. Enough.
Maria's 33-year-old husband has been away for a year and a half, more than half of the lifespan of their young daughter. She's told AM that President Putin's decree announcing the mobilisation of 300,000 conscripts is in breach of the constitution and federal legislation overseeing military service.
We advocate for the abolition of mobilisation, for the abolition of Decree 647. If we look into this decree, there is absolutely no mention that our men should be in Ukraine. There are no fixed goals there at all about why these people are called to the conflict zone.
Maria says the Defence Ministry has threatened the protesters' husbands, but police are yet to arrest the women. She says she's overcome her fear of protesting because her husband's life is more important to her. Boris Nadezhdin, the anti-war politician banned from running against President Putin, has told AM that these women do pose a threat to the Kremlin.
In this time, year before, they said something like, Mr. Putin, we support you. We support special military operation, but just return our men and take some others. Now the situation is quite different. This woman is absolutely against Putin and against special military operation.
It's unlikely the mobilisation decree will be reversed. The UK Ministry of Defence estimates that 350,000 Russian soldiers have been either killed or wounded in the past 2 years. This is Steve Kinnane reporting for AM.
To Indonesia now, where the outgoing president is set to leave a $45 billion new capital city project in the jungle for his successor to build. Nusantara is still a muddy construction site, but the race is on to get enough built to hold a National Day ceremony there in August. Funding problems and a reluctance by some public servants to move there are raising doubts about the city's future. Here's Indonesia correspondent Bill Bertels.
Whether in tropical rain or under the blazing sun, the workers at the new capital site on the island of Borneo don't stop. 10,000 of them toiling away to build a remote utopian haven for Indonesia's leaders and bureaucrats surrounded by jungle. Bambang Susantono is the man chosen by the president to oversee this mega project.
We are going to develop not only a city but a capital city. And not only a capital city but a sustainable forest city, with all the principle of green, smart, inclusive, resilient and sustainable.
It's an epic job.
President Republic Indonesia, Bapak Joko Widodo.
Indonesia's President Joko Widodo regularly flies in from the current capital, Jakarta, to oversee groundbreaking ceremonies for new offices, schools and hospitals.
These groundbreaking ceremonies prove the earnestness of our commitment that we're ready to build Nusantara into a world-class capital.
His term will finish later this year, and the new capital is his biggest legacy. The first batch of around 10,000 civil servants are supposed to relocate there this year. Some, like Arif Prastillo, are a bit anxious about moving to what is still largely a construction site.
The first time I was told that I'd be one of the first to be moved, of course I was nervous. I was anxious about my family. What sort of education would there be for my child? What sort of health facilities would there be?
Many will have to stay in Jakarta longer, a city plagued by traffic congestion, air pollution and land subsidence problems. In total, less than 2 million of Greater Jakarta's 30 million people are supposed to end up living in Nusantara when it's complete in 20 years' time. But economist Yusuf Wibisono says with Indonesia's government unable to convince any foreign investors to commit funds, the city might end up being a stalled project.
Even though the president has a promise that the next government will continue building the new capital, I believe at some point there will be the momentum and political courage to re-evaluate this project.
Indonesia's recently elected next president, Prabowo Subianto, has promised to keep building. So the immediate question is, can enough be built in time to celebrate Indonesia's Independence Day in August? And possibly to switch the official capital status to Nusantara by the end of this year. This is Bill Birtles in Jakarta reporting for AM.
And you can see more of that story tonight on Foreign Correspondent. With more obese Australians than ever before, doctors say they're increasingly seeing children with health problems caused by their weight. They include sleep apnea, high blood pressure, pre-diabetic symptoms and chronic knee pain. Experts believe junk food advertising is part of the problem, as Annie Guest reports.
You asked, we listened. The McFeast is back in all its beefy...
Advertisements for unhealthy food are in the spotlight as Australia's obesity epidemic worsens.
In Australia, around one in four children are living with overweight or obesity.
Dr. Bridget Kelly is an expert in public health and nutrition at the University of Wollongong.
Most children don't meet the recommended vegetable intakes and are eating too much discretionary or extra foods and beverages.
Did someone say KFC?
I don't care!
In recent years, research has shown kids are seeing up to 300 junk food ads a week. And the World Health Organization has found it influences what they eat.
And it pulled data from almost 20,000 children. And that study found that children's exposure to food marketing was associated with changes to their food intake, their food choices and their food preferences.
Dr. Kelly has authored a consultation paper on restricting unhealthy food advertising targeting children. It was commissioned by the federal government.
For online marketing, options put forward include restriction on banner ads and the like, but also things like influencer marketing.
The discussion paper, which is currently open for public comment, also looks at TV.
The policy option is around restricting the major broadcast period of the day.
The idea of restricting junk food ads that target children has strong support from doctors. Brisbane dietitian turned GP, Dr. Terry Lynn South, says she's increasingly treating children with health problems caused by their weight.
The issue most concerning is that associated with metabolic health, so that may be increased blood pressure, which may be signs of insulin resistance, including increased glucoses, as well as blood fats known as cholesterol and triglycerides.
You mentioned you also see orthopaedic factors. What are you seeing in their limbs?
So they can get some changes in the angles of their knees, which means that they can be in chronic pain.
And Dr. South also treats overweight and obese children for mental health problems.
Because they are being bullied about their size and shape at school.
The federal government's consultation paper on unhealthy food advertising is open for public comment until next Friday.
That's Annie Guest reporting, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.